At the close of World War II, as American troops were advancing into the heartland of Nazi Germany, and they had crossed the Rhine and eventually were in Germany proper, especially as they got into Bavaria, near a town called München or Munich, they came upon a place called Auschwitz. Meanwhile, the Russian armies advancing through Poland had come across a number of places named like Majdanek, Baden-Belsen, Buchenwald, Dachau, and 100 others. There are documentaries, many of which I have seen, that show the scarecrow-like survivors of the German Holocaust, of the so-called Holocaust that was named really by the Jews, of the pogroms against the Jews that allegedly took more than 6 million lives during the course of World War II, during the years when I was a boy in Eugene, Oregon, from about 11 to 15. In those innocent boys, boyhood memories of mine going up to my grandmother's farm, knowing very little of what was going on in Europe, except what the headlines told me, which, as we all know, is oftentimes propaganda and very greatly shaded by a wartime censorship that was imposed upon the media during those days. I knew nothing of that until after the war was over. There were some people in Germany who lived within 30, 40, 50 miles of some of the cities where the big smokestacks were belching human waste every day, who knew very little of what was going on. There were some who suspected it because of the terrible odor, and some who suspected that the fine whitish ash that came floating down out of the skies upon them in the city of Auschwitz might not be normal. I'll never forget the picture of some of these people who came forward as the military photographers were filming their rescue, and they recognized the baggy pants of the American Army and these GIs in khaki who were standing there with mud all over their boots, and these scarecrow-like figures in their striped prisoners' costumes threw themselves to the mud and the ground and grabbed these old, rough-bearded, slogging American foot soldiers by their muddy boots and just held on to them and cried. They were delivered. They were the survivors. They were going to escape. There are many kinds of bondage in the world, many places down through history where human beings have been held in bondage, in slavery. I am deeply ashamed of the incredible sins of my forebears who came to these lands in some of the original colonies, and some of those forebears of mine who were, as we call, Caucasian, indicating they came from the Caucasus, which is not true. But some of them were actually the leaders of the country, among them George Washington, who owned people. We have among us here today some of our black brethren and all different shades in between. Where black people sold black people and where Arab traders would plunder and pillage among some of the Gold Coast and the Ivory Coast settlements of some of the West African blacks. And the slave trade, when you read about it, and the incredible privation endured by people who were jammed like sardines and chained with just enough space to breathe, not even enough space to move over, on ships that plunged and tossed for sometimes a month and more at a time to come to the West Indies, and where human excreta, or human urine and excrement, was right there under their bodies. They all had to smell one another. If you think about it, it is literally a miracle that any of them even got here alive, and sometimes the death toll was up to 50% and more. The things that human beings have done to other human beings down through the years are just almost impossible to understand unless you understand that the men who perpetrated it, the people at the helm of those governments who were complicit in it, the people who started those programs to exterminate and to annihilate or to enslave other human beings must have been influenced by Satan, the devil himself, and his demonic spirits, because you can't understand it if we use the term humanity. We're very proud of the term humanitarian, and we talk about our humanitarian instincts in preserving the whales and little mice and rabbits and animals, that we talk about the human characteristic, which we like to claim is like the characteristics of God, that if we really let our humanity out, then that automatically carries with it the feeling of mercy, of caring, of wanting to help and to serve and to share, to give to other people, because that is the nobility of the human race. We need to learn, according to the First Lady, and to redefine right now in the United States, quote, what it means to be a human being in the 20th century. Well, I think one of the things that it should include when we redefine the meaning of being a human being is never to forget our roots. Never forget history. Never forget the lesson of the past. The original Passover did not come about as a result of the repentance of the forebears of the 10 lost tribes of Israel and the house of Judah. It came about instead as a result of God's mercy and the promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob at the end of an allotted span of time when God was going to break the manacles, he was going to loosen the shackles, he was going to allow people to come out of bondage. The first Passover was the breaking of the hold on people who were slaves. It was the release out of a lifelong experience of every kind of paganism and of slavery for a people who had become so inured to it, so accustomed to it, so much a part of their society, that they really didn't even want to go out of slavery. They argued with Moses when he explained to them what he was about. The Bible plainly says, didn't they say, when they got out to the area where they were shut in by the wilderness and they saw the chariots of the Egyptian army and they knew the tens of thousands of armed Egyptians with chariots and foot soldiers were coming after them to kill them, is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you've led us out here in the wilderness to die? Didn't we tell you this would happen when we were back there? Leave us in because slavery is better than coming out here and dying in the wilderness. I would rather be a slave and be alive, they said, than to be free and to die. Well, thanks be to God, many people down through history, including the founding fathers of this nation, including many a GI that went out to fight for home and mom and apple pie and country, felt very differently about it. They would rather be dead than be a slave, because being a slave and being in bondage is not living at all. It's a horrible existence that is unimaginable. If you'll turn to the 12th chapter of the book of Exodus, we will rehearse just a little bit what this was all about. The Eternal spoke unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month, Abib, or the green ears month, shall be unto you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year unto you. Sometimes that month was late. That is, sometimes the barley harvest was late. Sometimes weather interfered. And sometimes the months didn't progress exactly the same according to climatic patterns. And so sometimes when they looked at that new moon and it was obvious that the barley harvest was not going to be ripe in time for them to declare it was the month Abib, or green ears, they delayed it. It was called a postponement. Now, there are some religious people here and there, some amateur theologians and others, who say they had no right to do that. There was never any right on their part to postpone anything because they believe in holy time and holy places. They have not read of the examples of the observance of a Passover in the second month and the observance of an unauthorized, unwritten, non-canonical Days of Unleavened Bread beginning on the 15th day of that second month, nor apparently have they read of a second observance of another 7 days of unleavened bread following that, and of how Almighty God blessed from heaven the king of Judah who did it and the great reform that took place during the days of Josiah. So this was the beginning of months, and it was a month that had to do with the seasons, with the green ear coming up of the spring crops that could be eaten. Speak ye to the congregation of Israel, saying, in the 10th day of this month they shall take to them every man a lamb, according to the house of their fathers, a lamb for an house. We see in later revelations it could also be a kid, I think just in a couple of verses. If the household be too little for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next unto his house take it according to the number of people there are, because two people or three people couldn't eat one lamb. Take it according to the number of the people. Souls is the Hebrew ruach, meaning individuals, or in this case, persons or individuals. Every man according to his eating shall make your account for the lamb. your lamb shall be without blemish, completely free of any deformity, a white, beautiful, little, innocent lamb. A male of the first year, you shall take it out from the sheep or from the goats. It could be a little kid of a goat. Never forget the day when my little neighborhood friend, Delmer Jeske, came running down to my house and said, "Come quick, I want to show you my newest pet." And we went about four houses down to where he lived, and there out in back of his garage, he had a little baby lamb that was only a few days old. And it stood there and bleated, and it was the cutest little thing I about ever saw. And we could pick it up. It was so tiny, and cuddle it, and had the cutest little face. And you could scratch it on the back and pet it. And he produced a bottle that his mother had given him that was a baby bottle, and put it up that little lamb's mouth, and the little lamb began nursing very noisily on a baby bottle. It was one of the cutest little animals I ever saw. That experience would have ruined me to have stood around 10 days later and watched somebody slit that lamb's throat. I could never have eaten that particular lamb. We've all heard stories, sometimes very cruel stories, about 100 different things to do with a dead cat, for example, a humorous book you can find in the bookstore. Or different things about people who have had animals as pets and then ended up with them for Thanksgiving or something like that. The turkey that followed the kids around. There are all kinds of stories, and sometimes people put humorous twists upon them. But a lamb was chosen because a lamb, perhaps of all the domesticated animals, is so tiny and so helpless and so innocent and so completely unthreatening and so beautiful, a tiny little lamb. And you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month, and the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel, they were to gather and to do this, the priests were to do it, shall kill it in the evening. I wonder if they had time between the 10th and the 14th in those 4 days to get attached to that little lamb. The kids did. I imagine some of the kids did. And probably it was a lesson that was filled with a certain amount of horror. If you're sitting there thinking these people were saying, "Would you hurry and kill the lamb? I'm hungry." I don't think it happened like that. I think some of the women looked away, don't you? I think maybe even some of the men looked away. I think the priests had to perform the ceremony, but I don't think it was all that delightful or all that fascinating to everybody that they had to kill those lambs in the evening. I will not digress for the purposes for which I want to bring you this message today into arguments about when the evening was or the date. That's all in the Passover booklet, and we can do that at another time, perhaps during the days of unleavened bread. They were to keep it and to kill it in the evening, the Hebrew expression, between the two evenings. This was on the 14th, and evening does mean, according to internal evidence in the Bible, time and time again, in the book of Numbers, here in the book of Exodus, at the going down or the going away of the sun. At the end of the 14th, and after they killed it, and as they were preparing it, nighttime had come on, and they had now entered into the 15th day of that month. They shall eat the flesh in that night. Oh, first of all, they shall kill it in the evening, verse 7, and they shall take the blood and strike it. Now, they did this with a wisp of hyssop, which is like salt sage, a kind of a fan-shaped, brush-like weed that was used, and it was used as a cleansing agent. They took the hyssop, which was a desert plant, and they dipped it in the blood, and they splashed it, or they painted it, on the lintels and the doorposts. A bloody ceremony, right? Not the normal thing you'd want to put on your windows and doors. Blood dripping down. Well, you looked out there, and of course they probably lived in either stone or what we would call adobe-type dwellings at that time. They weren't lumber that came from Washington and Oregon. They were materials that came to hand. Some of them maybe even shanty-type things because they were slaves. They could have even been little houses of mud and reeds. They could have been built of the same kinds of bricks that the Israelites were making for some of the monuments and the buildings of Egypt, which is my leaning on that subject. But they struck the blood on the doors and on the windows of their homes and retired inside. They shall eat the flesh in that night, roast with fire, and unleavened bread, and with bitter herbs shall they eat it, not savory spices, not salt, but bitter herbs. Eat not of it raw, nor sodden at all with water, that is boiled. It was to be roasted, broiled, like charbroiled, directly in the flame. but roast with fire, his head with his legs, and with all the pertinence thereof. It was not to be dismembered. The legs were not to be severed from the body. The head was not to be severed. It wasn't to be butchered and cut up in little pieces and put on a spit with nothing but the body there and turned over and over like an old Texas barbecue. The whole animal was to be burnt in the fire. And you shall let nothing of it remain until the morning. And that which remains of it until the morning you shall burn with fire was to be completely and totally consumed. It was an holy offering by fire. Cost, C-A-U-S-T, in Hebrew, is an offering made by fire. Hala, or holocaust, is a holy offering made by fire. It was this event in Jewish history that gave rise to the term the Holocaust, because they said, we Jews are the sacrificial lambs this time. We don't have a lamb to offer. This time, it is us, with the legs and the arms and the hair and the teeth and the body and all the pertinence thereof. And the Germans were going to let nothing of it remain until the morning. If you've ever wondered the origin of the term Holocaust and its insane application by some news media people and writers and other people to something that has no connection whatsoever with what occurred to the Jews during World War II, now you know. It is taken from a Hebrew expression that has to do with an offering, a holy offering made by fire. And thus shall you eat it, with your loins girded. That is, they wore a kind of a semi-dress, like a skirt. And they would take it and tuck it up into a big leathern belt, gathered up around their legs, so that it would unencumber their knees and their ankles. And shoes on your feet. And they never, in that part of the world, wore their shoes indoors. Just like in that part of the world to this day. I've been in many an Arab home, and sometimes, depends on where you are, I guess, but they still do it in Arab countries where they have like what we would call throw rugs, area rugs, perhaps on a stone floor. They'll have a foyer. You take off your shoes, and you slip on some little paper ones or some little indoor slippers, and you walk on in. Same thing in Japan. The Oriental countries traditionally did that. So having their shoes on their feet indoors meant they were really in an emergency situation. They didn't even have time to stop in the foyer and put them on. They were to be on their feet. And your staff in your hand. Now that was a big walking stick or a cane, and the elderly people always carried those, and many other people did. They were handy to ward off snakes and handy to prevent a fall and perhaps even handy to protect yourself. Who knows? And you shall eat it in haste. It is the Eternal's Passover. For I will pass through the land of Egypt this night, and will smite all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Eternal. And the blood shall be to you for a token upon the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. That's all Passover means. It means pass on by. We're going to have a pass on by. It means skip over. We're going to have a skip over. It means omit. It means exempt. Forget it. Go to the next place. We're going to have a forget it. Go to the next place. Puts a different feeling on the ceremony, doesn't it, when you really understand the meaning of the phrase that the death angel who was going to mete out horrible punishment would pass over their homes. He was there. He was right outside. He was coming to their address. He was going to look at their door. And when he saw the blood, let's pass over this one. Let's check next door. That's the way it happened. It was the pass on by, the Passover. And the plague shall not be upon you to destroy you when I smite the land of Egypt. And this day shall be unto you for a memorial, and you shall keep it a feast to the Eternal. Throughout your generations, you shall keep it a feast by an ordinance forever. 7 days they were to eat that meal with unleavened bread. Draw yourself a chart sometime. Just divide 7 days into seven little blocks and label the first one the 15th and the last one the 21st. Just label them and label one ahead of that the 14th and then have a little place just before the first mark there for even at the going down of the sun late in the afternoon, the early evening. And then you can understand this verse. Otherwise, you can never understand it. You'll be hopelessly entangled in making all kinds of mistakes that other churches have made, trying to determine that Jesus actually did keep the legitimate Passover, but the Jews had made a terrible mistake. And yet the same people that would argue that would go around and say the Jews could never have made a mistake because they're the people we depend upon for the holy calendar. They're the people we depend upon for the correct chronology. They're the people we depend upon for retaining the knowledge of the Sabbath, which is non-observable and astronomical phenomena. It is not something we observe in nature. It has only been retained in the memory and the minds of living generation after generation of Jewish people. And we demonstrate that the weekly Sabbath is the Sabbath because time has not been lost. Then does it make sense that during Jesus' day the Jews were keeping the Passover on an unauthorized, wrong, erroneous day? And we can get real holy if we keep it on a different day. No, it makes no sense at all, but there are those who would still argue with you on that issue. So, he says, 7 days shall you eat unleavened bread. Even the first day you shall put away leaven out of your houses. For whosoever eateth leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that individual shall be cut off from Israel. Did I say ruach previously? Let me correct that. It's nephesh, N-E-P-H-E-S-H, if I said ruach. Ruach is the Hebrew word for spirit, and nephesh is the word translated soul in all cases in the English. 7 days of unleavened bread, not eight. If the day on which the Paschal Lamb was slain was a day of unleavened bread, then you've got 8 days of unleavened bread, but the Bible plainly says 7 days of unleavened bread. It then goes on into some of the sacrifices and all the things that had to be done during that time. Why did God bring those people out of Egypt? It was because of no goodness of their own. They had done nothing to deserve it. They were merely the progeny of Abraham, Isaac, and of Jacob. They were the progeny of Joseph and all of his brethren. Joseph, who because of avarice and cunning had been sold into slavery, one of the brothers says, let's kill him. Judah says, no, there's money to be made, let's sell him. And so they sold him into slavery, and from that time on, those peoples who were prolific were blessed and protected of God and grew up to be a nation of perhaps some 3 million individuals in slavery as a captive host of people doing most of all the work. Many of the women would travel from their little hovels and during that day would probably catch public conveyances or be conveyed by their mistress to one of the Egyptians' homes. We know that Moses' own mother nursed him as a babe because she served the daughter of Pharaoh. You've read the story of how Moses was found in the bulrushes. And, of course, Moses' own mother was one of the maids, a serving lady, to the daughter of the king. And so many of the women, on a daily basis, merely went to houses. Now, the women became attached to their mistresses and vice versa. And they were just exactly like some of the arguments that would come out of the plantation owners around Nashville, Tennessee, and all along the Mississippi River and its tributaries, and up into North and South Carolina and Virginia, that eventually tore this nation apart in a civil war in the middle 1860s, about the time my grandmother was born. It was a way of life. We don't look upon our coloreds as slaves. We treat them like one of our own. That was true in many cases. There were some that argued, we say to this man, you're free. He would say, Massa, what does that mean, I's free? Oh yes, it's written. It's a part of the history of the time. They would argue that they're not even human beings because they'd taken people out of savagery who had had no education, who couldn't even speak the language, and at the end of the whip and the lash had turned them into beasts of burden, had turned them into mules and horses, had turned them into people out in the fields to do all of their work. But that wasn't the only kind of work they did any more than the Israelites experienced the same kind of task work in Egypt. Building bricks wasn't their only task. They changed babies. They washed pots and pans. And they cleaned house. And little by little, they developed an affinity for some of those children. There were women who probably wept because they wouldn't get to see little Johnny, what's his name, grow up. A young Egyptian lad that they had known from the time he was born. These people were absolutely part and parcel of their society. They were deeply enmeshed in it. The Egyptian gods were as good as any gods. Do you think for 1 minute the Israelites were in there? Oh, this is paganism. Oh, that's terrible. Look, there's old Tutmos over there saying something to this scarecrow god with a head of a jackal and a body of a man. Oh, that's paganism. Are you kidding? They loved it. What were the stories about the gods? Why did they worship things like scarabs, which tended to turn up when you left human excrement out in public? Why did they worship things like alligators and crocodiles? Well, crocodiles, they are not alligators, but the same type of kind. And actually mummify them. Why do they mummify a beetle, a huge big beetle that fed on human excrement? Why would they mummify dogs and cats? Well, they worshipped all these things, because it was so stupid and so ignorant that they thought that a godlike life was in animal life. They thought that the Nile was a god. They worshipped the Nile. That's why God smote it and turned it to blood. They thought cattle were gods. They wouldn't eat those. The Israelites had many, many cattle, but the Egyptians didn't. They shunned cattle. They looked upon cattle like modern-day Indians, the second most populous nation in the world today, who thinks a cow is a god. They worship a cow. A cow is God. These people were as much a part of their society as many blacks became a part of their slave owners' society during their day. I have read how Thomas Jefferson treated his slaves, how he had a mistress among those slaves, how apparently there were children generated from that mistress. And this was true right across the entire spectra of slave ownership. There was every kind of concourse back and forth. My own wife has told me a time when she was a little baby girl and that her parents had a maid who worked to help clean. This is way, of course, this side of slavery, as you understand. And now we're down in the modern times in our lifetime. And little Shirley was probably 2.5 or 3. She was probably not a whole lot older than my little granddaughter. And the black lady who kept house for them was going to leave one day, and she cried. And she clung to her, and she wanted to go with her, because the black lady was like a nursemaid, and she helped look after those children growing up. And the black lady had to explain it. I'm probably going to get it wrong, so I better not go into great detail. But she had to tell little Shirley that you can't go with me because I'm black, and I've got to go where I live. And you're a little white girl, and you live here with the Hammers, and you've got to stay here. And dried her tears and tried to explain to her why you can't go to live with me. But you see, little Shirley, my wife, loved that lady because that lady was so sweet and so kind to her and was a nursemaid and helped bring her up. You see, these people in Egypt were nursemaids. Some of them held little Egyptian babies to their breast. They were wet nurses. Now, if you're thinking for 1 minute, if you somehow got the idea in past years as you read through all of these words here in the Bible that these were a godly, God-fearing, God-worshipping, Ten Commandment-keeping bunch of people, and they were just saying, look at the paganism, look at all the drugs, because they were using things like mandrakes and herbs and poultices, all kinds of powders. They were smoking things and ingesting things and sticking things in their lip. They stuck things in their cheek, walked around chewing on it. They had things that they could put in various orifices of their body to make them feel a little bit better, and they were slaves to whatever it was that made them feel good because they were hedonists. They were licentious. They were looking for the good life, the good taste, the good experience. Sexual promiscuity was absolutely rampant and rife in their religion as well as their way of life. Question. Interrogate your memory. What was the very first thing they did, and their patience was pretty short-lived. It lasted exactly 1 month and 10 days, when Moses delayed to come down from the mountain. Well, old Aaron had quite an excuse. He said, you see, the people came to me. He was one of our first great Democrats. The people came to him. And the people rose up. And the people said, make us gods to go before us. So he gave in to what the people wanted. What's good for the people is what the people want. And the people rose up and had delegates, and they were demonstrating. There were demonstrations here. As for this Moses, one of their spokesmen said, we don't have the faintest idea what's become of him. Make us gods to go before us. We need a standard. We need a rallying point here. We need something to rally around. When Moses came back and broke the Ten Commandments, said, Aaron, what in the world happened? Aaron had this little tremble chin, spineless jellyfish, quiver voice, and said, I don't know. The people made me do it. They gave me all these earrings and bangles and spangles and bracelets, and I tossed it all in the fire, and this calf came out. It's what it says in the Bible. It's one of the dumbest things you've ever read, an excuse that is beyond belief. Trying to make his own brother Moses think that the fire did that all by itself. We threw all the jewelry in, this calf came out of there. Well, nonsense. He made a mold. It was done on purpose. And the calf stood for something. It stood for everything they left behind. It stood for everything that they missed. It stood for a riotous, big old, wonderful, naked orgy. And they proceeded to have themselves one. 24,700 of them died as a result. They decided to get naked after they got good and drunk, and they were having a gigantic riotous bash and orgy, and I mean people running everywhere in every stage of undress. It didn't matter who they encountered, whoever turned you on, get it on. And that's the age you live in today. So they were slaves in many ways, weren't they? They were not unwilling slaves. There were many, many slaves that when they were given their freedom, elected to stay right there on that plantation in a little sharecropper's cabin and till the same soil their granddaddy had tilled and to stay right in the area. They didn't all immediately uproot and just leave Virginia and take off for Detroit or someplace. No way. Many of them stayed right there and helped to try to restore a burnt out plantation and to bring those crops back. Now, you and I don't really look at our past lives as slavery. We don't look at the hold, the grip that Satan the devil had on us, body, mind, and spirit, as slavery. We don't think that we were his prized possession. We don't think that he could just whisper in our ear and get us to do anything he wanted us to do on a moment's notice. We like to think, in our pride and our vanity, Satan, he never could make any headway with me. Now, I know that there are weak people out there. I know the devil can whisper in their ear, not me. I am a tough nut to crack. I'm a tough cookie. I know. I have got willpower. Today, we live in a world that is characterized by Jesus' statement, "Remember Lot's wife." And I have covered that many a time because I've characterized the growth of the movement of homosexuality in ancient Sodom and Gomorrah. There were two cities, twin cities, nearby each other, as a very gradual thing. There were not two cities that just magically, poof, appeared with 5,000 inhabitants each, all of whom were either lesbians, homosexuals, or sodomites. No, there had to be a time when in those cities where there was life, normal life, that there were people who began to indulge in those horrible sins. And little by little, it infected other people. And little by little, it grew until finally it became acceptable. And finally, the city or the town fathers began doing it and approving it and were part of it until the entire society. Finally, you had leaders who said that we need more lesbians and we need more sodomites and we need more homosexuals in positions here in Sodom, because before that time, some of you straight people have been discriminating against them. And they deserve a fair shake. And eventually, the whole city became completely homosexualized. And now we remember Abraham arguing for the sake of Lot and his family. If you can find 50 righteous, will you spare it? Sure. If you find 40 righteous, will you spare it? Well, yes, I will. Oh, be not angry with me, but dare I speak once again. If you found even 30 righteous in that town, would you spare it? Yes, I would. What about 15? Yes. 10? Yes. How about 5? Yes, even if I could find 5 decent people, 5 good people, 5 righteous living according to my laws in the city of Sodom, I would spare the whole place. He could only find 1. Not 2, just 1. Lot. Not his wife, and not even his virginal daughters. It's quite a commentary. I want you to think about that for a minute. On how incredibly inured, jaded, exhausted, and overcome by their society and the pressures around them, that family was, for that man, Lot, to have offered his 2 virginal daughters, 2 little girls he dandled on his knee, the little babies he'd kissed and helped change their little diapers that they used during those days, 2 little girls he'd watched grow up, watched them bud out to become young women, watched their little breasts form, watch them become desirable young teenagers, He loved them. They loved him, their daddy. They loved their mummy. They were a close-knit family. They were not really indulging. The daughters weren't lesbians. They weren't yet. Not yet, anyway. But here were two visitors, because Lot must have known that there was something very different about these visitors, because they were angels. They were angels unawares. They were angelic beings in human form. And he offered his two virginal daughters to a gang of sadistic rapists and sodomites who probably had every disease you could imagine. They were Gentiles. They were not circumcised. I won't go on that line of reasoning, but he gives these two daughters on his doorstep and says, "Oh, please don't assault these men. They're my house guests. Let me give you my two daughters who have never known man." What a commentary on how far a family had been twisted by the society in which they lived. You can't imagine it, can you? Is there a human being, is there a father or a grandfather in this audience that could even imagine doing such a thing? You would be held accountable of God, I guess, because you'd say, "I'm sorry, fellas, I can't protect you," but it would never enter your mind to take your two daughters out of their bedroom back there and say, "Go ahead, fellas, you can have them." It wouldn't enter the mind of a man in my audience. But it did his. That shows you to what extent that society had affected those people. And so Jesus Christ said, "Remember Lot's wife." Now, what do you suppose there was for these Israelites to partake of back in ancient Egypt? You can read about the history of the time. You can look in the monuments. You can read from the Egyptian Demotic. And you can understand a great deal of their mythology. And you know they had drugs. They used aphrodisiacs, mandrakes. They used various powders and potions and poultices. They used the black arts. They used magicry. They had their high priesthood of magicians. What did the magicians do? The magicians, by demonic power, by the power of Satan himself, were able to duplicate in some small measure every plague that Moses and Aaron call down upon the people in Egypt until the plague of lice. And now there were so many of them, they ran out of demons. And there were so many billions of lice, and they were everywhere, just covering man and animal and the land, that finally the magicians had to tell Pharaoh, "This is the finger of God. We can't duplicate this." And you see the example of a rod that actually turned into a snake? And they threw down their rods and they turned into snakes. And Moses' great big rod that turned into a large snake ate the other two snakes. Remember the story? Get some insight into what these people lived like, what their lives were like. They were part and parcel of Egyptian households. They were friendly with them. They knew their religion. They knew their language. They knew their calendar. They knew their holy days. They knew their religious rites and rituals. They knew their hedonism and their amorality and their sexual promiscuity. They knew the pagan mythology about their gods cavorting around in heaven and doing all sorts of illegal and illicit things with each other. Which explains that only 40 days after Moses' authority was gone, they reverted immediately back to where they'd been. I have been in many a sermon where I have quoted or I've heard other people quote what Peter said, "It has happened according to the true proverb, the sow that was washed is returned to the mire, and the dog is turned again unto his own vomit." I've also lived in this sad old 64-year-old body long enough to remember many people who sat and looked up eagerly on those Friday night Bible studies, who sat there in Sabbath services, who attended Ambassador College classes, who came to the Feast of Tabernacles, and something finally clicked in their head, and they said, "That did it. That's the straw that broke the camel's back. Now I'm really angry." And for the last several years, their homes have been festooned with Christmas trees. They're happily puffing on cigarettes. They take the name of God in vain. And they're back exactly the way they used to be. When I was thinking about this, I thought of how I used to smoke and how it took so much for me to overcome it. And I thought of a time when I was doing a radio program in which I characterized the little white weed as the great God before whom a person who smoked worshipped. Well, very quickly, in about 10 minutes before I came over here, I grabbed my computer and I made out a little ode to a weed. This is in honor of all of those who say, cigarettes don't have any control over me. I can quit anytime. Ode to a weed. O little brown weed in a field, it is to thee and thee alone I yield. Plucked up art thou, root and branch, hung in a shed to dry and to blanch, toasted, roasted, and shredded by machine, and rolled in a little paper roll so white and so clean, equipped with cotton filters or menthol or some other such brew, but mostly loaded with that thing that I crave, nicotine. O little cigarette, my master, my boss, before thee I bow, all willpower is lost. You tell me when and where, and I humbly obey as I light up in restaurants and markets and shops about 40 times every day. I boast, oh, I can quit. I've proved it many times. When deep down inside, I know that I am all thine. I quiver before you, my little white wrapped weed. You are my habit, my companion, my desire, my every need. That's why I reach for you daily and smoke you so gaily, you nicotine-laden little weed. What was that? What was that you said just then? What were your orders? Oh, it's time to pull out a fresh pack and light up and prove to myself again and again that I only smoke because I want to, not because I have any need. I keep kidding myself. But really, I obey my little weed. You know, there are many kinds of slavery. They are habits that get a hold of you. They're habits that affect your thinking. Habits that affect your bloodstream, habits that affect your digestive system, habits that affect your circulatory and your nervous system. And people become addicted to them, sometimes quite innocently, like our former First Lady Betty Ford of some years ago. Doctors prescribe things that make us feel better, and little by little, without realizing it, we say, I want to get rid of this pain, and we reach for that bottle and we take it again. Again, I'm thinking in poetry all the time now, all of a sudden. There are all kinds of slavery. And I want you to ask this question as we turn to the 18th chapter of the book of Revelation. To what extent have you come out of slavery? To what extent have the shackles been broken? Verse 4 of 18th chapter of Revelation, I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. To what extent are we products of our past? How much of a hold does this world have on you? How much of a hold does your past religion, your political persuasion, your political party of choice, your part of the country, the colloquialisms and the down-home slang, your family, your friends? To what extent are you influenced as you look at issues that are brought before you by all of that past, that kaleidoscopic, many-faceted past that really is the mold, you see, the matrix out of which you came, which produced you, which made you what you are? To what extent has that been broken to where you will never revert? There's no way that in 40 short days, absent some kind of authority from God, that you would find yourself back again if you used to be fairly well addicted to marijuana. We have talked privately, but we've also mentioned in the ministerial council, and we've mentioned, I think, out of the pulpit, that the time is going to come, and in fact has already arrived, when we will have members of the Church of God International seated in a local congregation who have HIV positive. We have members in the Church of God International who used to be homosexuals. We pray that they are overcomers and that they have completely repented of that and that they used to be homosexuals. We have people who are converted former alcoholics. We have people who are still alcoholics. We have people who used to smoke, and we have many who still do. We have people who are chained and in bondage to various appetites of the flesh. I want you to turn to Isaiah 52 and read a scripture that gets passed over, unfortunately, quite often, in those portions that have to do with the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Isaiah 52 and we'll begin in verse 11. Depart ye, depart ye, go out from thence, just as we read in Revelation 18:4. Come out of her, my people. 1 John 2:15, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him, meaning the society. Touch no unclean thing. Another thing many people revert to is their dietary habits. They say, I really miss my pork roast and my blackened catfish and all my seafood and everything. Miss it. So, go ye out of the midst of her, exactly as we read in Revelation 18:4, be ye clean that bear the vessels of the eternal. By implication, the church, looking at the priesthood who bore the holy vessels of the temple. For you shall not go out with haste, nor by night. Ah, so he's referring back, isn't he, to the experience of ancient Israel at the time of the Passover. For the Eternal will go before you, and the God of Israel will be your rear guard, your rear reward. Behold, my servant, that's Christ, shall deal prudently. He shall be exalted and extolled and be very high. As many as were astonished at thee, his visage was so marred, more than any man, meaning that he did not look human, he was so beaten and his face was so disfigured, and his form more than the sons of men. So shall he sprinkle many nations. The high priest sprinkled the blood on the vessels in a ceremony on the Day of Atonement. And the wounds were so manifold in the body of Jesus Christ that they were weeping blood from dozens and dozens of sources. The king shall shut their mouths at him. They will walk up to taunt and look and shut their mouth and not be able to talk. For that which had not been told them shall they see, and that which they had not heard shall they consider. Who has believed our report? Men divided it into chapters. God did not. To whom is the arm of the Eternal revealed? For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of a dry ground. He has no form nor comeliness, and when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. As I have made very clear in the book called The Real Jesus, and that's totally contrary to the Protestant and Catholic idea, he is despised and rejected of men. And I covered that thoroughly in a sermon that I call Christ's Lonely Sacrifice. A man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. How many times in his lifetime did Jesus Christ engage in absolute frivolity, where he just gave himself over to a good old-fashioned fireside joke-telling session? Zero. How many times did Jesus Christ engage in tomfoolery? How many times did he get raucous or loud or wild? How many times was he completely awkward and inappropriate in his behavior around other people? How many times did he use scatological and bad language? How many times did he chortle or chuckle about someone else suffering or an animal being put to death? How many times did he laugh at a sick joke? Never. Never. He was a man who was despised, sometimes even by his own family, his own brothers. It's odd, but big man, do right up here in Galilee what they claim you do down in Jerusalem. Let us see some of your miracles. He had his own family who didn't really believe in him until after his resurrection. He is rejected of men. I know people who have moved out of cities, who have sold homes, gotten rid of businesses, and moved to other states because of rejection. And I've talked before about how the greatest form of rejection is within a family, where if you are rejected of your parent, a parent rejects the child, or the child rejects the parent, or a husband or a wife reject each other, that is probably more painful in many ways than dying. Dying is merciful in comparison. It doesn't take anywhere near so long. To be shot, be killed suddenly in an automobile accident, merciful in connection with thinking of a lifelong feeling of someone with whom you had incredible intimacy and love who has rejected you. I tried to point out in that sermon, I'll briefly recap for you, but you can get a tape of it if you didn't hear it, that many people tended to think of Jesus Christ's sacrifice as lasting for a few hours, beginning perhaps with the knowledge that they were coming to arrest him when he went out and flung himself on the ground, and he prayed three times and said, "Take this cup from me." And then that terrible all-night ordeal and all the next afternoon until he died. the beating, the dragging of the stake through the streets, the impaling, the affixing him to an upright pail that has since been called a cross, and the ideal that there were hours of agony and of thirst and of pain, and that finally he died. No, no, no. His sacrifice began from the moment of his birth. His sacrifice was his entire life's experience. It was a lifetime of experience of being a young boy coming through puberty and knowing just as full well as any other young Jewish boy in whom all the appropriate juices flowed that those little Jewish girls were just as cute as they could be. It was every time he could think about those around him who gave way to appetite and see somebody walking by who was very much evident of having given in to that appetite. It was when he forced himself to get up at the wee hours in the morning and go up to a mountain to pray because he thought today's going to be real rough. We're going by where little Susie lives. And whatever else he had to overcome, my Bible tells me that my Savior was tempted in every point like as we are, and that he had to fight it, that he had his part. He was not like the Olympic weightlifter that said, oh, a 100-pound weight here, I can do that real easy. And he just tossed off his experience as Savior in this earth and said, I have done it, it's finished, and went off to heaven, and that was the end of that. It was such a narrow thing. He placed himself at such great risk. There were times when he was desperately in need of more help from God's Holy Spirit and couldn't wait to get out of his bed and get to the top of a mountain completely away from people, where if he began to sob out loud and just broke down and bawled like a baby, cried out, oh God, help me, that nobody could hear him and he could be alone with his Father in heaven. Jesus Christ of Nazareth lived among men, and yet he was lonely. They didn't understand him. They took advantage of him. Judas hated him and was working against him and talking to Simon and all the others all the time, trying to disaffect them. He had a camaraderie and a special love between himself and John. Peter many times mishandled him, mistreated him, really actually talked very badly to him, grabbed him by the shoulders one time and shook him and said, that's not going to happen to you. And Jesus said, get thee behind me, Satan, you know not what spirit you're of. The Son of Man has come to save lives, not to destroy them. Peter said, why don't you call down fire like Elijah did when Ahab's representatives came and burn them up like so many little cinder blocks out there, so many burnt matches. Kill them all. They won't let you stay at the inn here in Samaria. Kill the miserable thing. Peter didn't like Samaritans. Peter was a racist. Peter had a lot of racial problems in his heart, and God had to get them out. God had to cause him to repent of that by showing him a vision at Joppa, making him realize that the Goyim, or the Gentiles, were also cleansed of God if they would repent, that they could be his fellow spiritual Israelites in God's church. He was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows. What made him sad? Remember the case of Lazarus? Remember how when Mary came out there and broke down? And here he had taught those people, he'd been with those people, they had traveled with him. The ladies carried the dunnage. Some of those two ladies, including his own mother, were with him on certain limited portions of his evangelistic trips around the Decapolis, the 10 cities up in the Golan Heights. And they had cooked his meals and cooked the meals of the other disciples. We don't get that picture without looking between the lines and the little hints that the New Testament writers give us. But those women had a lot of experiences. They had heard him by the hour. Remember the time about the Martha complex? When Mary came in, and Martha came in, rather, and said, will you make Mary come and help me with the dishes and help me with the work, Lord, because it's just more than I can bear. And he said, Martha, Martha, what am I to do with you? She's chosen that which is the best. She wants to sit here and to listen and to get the word of life. And you are very perturbed, Martha, about many things. Listen, housewives, please. That's what he said to her. Sorry, she had those dishes to wash. Ooh, that could be an argument, couldn't it? But Jesus said Mary had chosen the right thing. Acquainted with grief, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. He was acquainted with the grief of other human beings, and it moved him deeply because of their lack of faith. When Mary came out to him and said, oh, if you'd only been here in time, you could have saved him. But you didn't make it, and now he's dead. So that meant that this great, huge steel wall had come clanging down, and this great black unknown called death had hovered over, and now the man was absolutely beyond the reach of Jesus Christ. He was in the tomb. He was in the grave napkins. They'd put all the spices on his body. He'd been lying there for 4 solid days. By now, there must be a terrible odor because they knew it took about that long to begin a rather horrible process of decomposition. The body would bloat, be full of gases, be horrifying. She broke down, and she was just weeping. And they, during that day, hired, just like some people in New Orleans still do, people to attend the wake. See, Jewish families during that day could hire professional chanters and weepers. And they had professional people there. And they would make these keening sounds like an Arapaho Indian when her warrior didn't return from the battle. And it was a formal kind of a thing where they would wail through various prayers and poetry. And they would tear their hair, and they would rip their garments, and those Jewish people at that time made a terrible display of anguish of soul and of pain and suffering. When Jesus saw all of this, and even some instruments accompanying the weepers, shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept. I guess you've got to say it was from a combination of sorrow, of disappointment. It also had empathy mixed in with it. But if you think it was because he agreed with their sorrow, you're wrong, because he knew in his heart what he was going to do, and he simply right there in front of them didn't even bow, didn't close his eyes. He just looked up to heaven and said, Father, I thank thee that you have heard me, and I know that you hear me always. But for these people who are here, I said it. And he said it in a voice loud enough for them to hear. And he said, Lazarus, come forth! And the door opened. A man came walking out, all bound up, with some of the rags starting to come off of him, and he said, loose him and let him go. Because he knew that Lazarus was coming out, his weeping could not have been hopelessness in the face of death. It had to be empathy and being moved because they just didn't get it. He lived in a crowd, and yet he was lonely. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep, and they'll just follow a big old ewe wherever she decides to go if the sheepdog isn't there to corral them and get them going where the shepherd wants them to, have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and we will argue until we're blue in the face that that's the best way. We know, and we are right. We enjoy being right. Our background, that matrix which produced us and made us what we are, is right. And we cling to it and we treasure it, and some of us don't know that we're guilty of self-idolatry, that the greatest God we worship is our own opinions, our own attitudes. And instead of looking up to God and saying, surely all of our righteousnesses are as filthy rags before thee, and when I have done all that is commanded me, say I'm an unprofitable servant, I have done that which is my duty to do, many of us cling to our arguments and our attitudes. We, like sheep, have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way, and the eternal has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed, and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb, a little, precious, helpless, white, perfect lamb, to the slaughter. And as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. If you'll turn to 1 Corinthians 5, I do not keep the Passover. We call it that in tradition. We have not changed the wording. It's impossible for me to keep a Passover. Why should I? Why should I let my children see me slit the throat of a lamb? Why should I take a little lamb like Delmer Jesky had and nurse it with the bottle and keep it a few days and kill the poor little thing and eat its roasted flesh and stand around and pretend that I've got my overcoat on and I'm with my shoes on and standing up and eat a meal of bitter herbs and be ready to go somewhere out the door? What would my neighbors think of me if I put blood all over my front door and my window sills? Why, they would think I'd gone crazy. And that's the Passover. I don't observe the Passover. I observe the Lord's Supper. I take the communion of the body of Jesus Christ. I observe with God's church a completely different, a unique New Testament, one and only, first time ever, ceremony that was given its sanctification and its holiness and its authorization by Jesus Christ of Nazareth, who on the night in which he was betrayed took bread and said, "Take and eat, this is my body which is broken for you," and passed the cup among them and said, "Drink ye all of this, this is the blood of the New Testament that is shed for the sins of many." In 1 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, let's read up to it from verse 6. "Your glorying is not good." These were hedonists. These were libertines. These were people who had gone back into their society, and they were going right back into some of the same old sins from which they had come. "Know you not that a little leaven," that is allowing one person who was openly, in this case, guilty of incest, and it was turning the heads of other people. Other people are like that. You know this thing of human nature that says, "Well, he got away with it. Maybe I can. I mean, he didn't get punished. He got away with it. Why can't I?" It's there. It's in a human mind. Don't you know that a little leaven leavens a whole lump? One rotten orange pretty soon will affect all the oranges in a box, or the rotten apple. "Purge out, therefore, the old leaven," which is a type of sin, "that you may be a new lump, as ye are unleavened." And that absolutely proves that they were observing the days of unleavened bread. They were physically unleavened, and he is encouraging them, purge out the old leaven, meaning the spiritual leaven, which is sin. "For even Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us." Christ is our Passover. He is, as John said at his baptism, "Behold, the Lamb of God." He is, according to John in the book of Revelation, the Lamb that was slain from the foundation of the world. He is the sacrifice that was unblemished and that was perfect, who never did or thought or said one evil thing, and was offered for the sins of all of mankind, because his one perfect, beautiful life was worth more than all the rest of mankind's lives put together, because he is the one who created Adam and Eve. He's the one who first talked to Adam and explained to him what he was. He's the one who sat there and got a chuckle out of Adam naming some of those animals, and hopefully did a better job than some of the Greeks did. He is the one who appeared to and ate a meal with Abraham, the one who wrestled in the dust of the earth with Jacob, the one who told him what his name was. He was the one who caused a bush to burn and watched Moses approach it. He was the one who said, "I'll put my hand over you, and when I pass by in this cloud, I'll let you look at my hind parts, but that's all you can see." He is the one who was Christ, our Passover, who was sacrificed for us. Therefore, verse 8, "Let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, neither with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth." Jesus Christ is our Passover. And even as much as that first Passover was to be displayed so that God would cause his death angel to skip by, to pass on over their homes and not to exact from them the penalty for sin, the loss of the firstborn of every home, whether he was 47 or 7 weeks, in those Egyptian households, died. And the screams of agony and shock that went up that night must have nearly filled the land. But the Israelites huddled indoors could only hear their neighbors, could only think, "I wonder if it was one of my favorite family's little boys who died this night." And the next day went out of bondage, out of the land of bondage, out of slavery. They didn't deserve it. They hadn't earned it. They weren't in their goodness ready to be delivered. They were in their badness, the children of Abraham, and God rescued them because what he'd promised our forebears. Thank God that that is so, because if it were not so, you nor I could ever make it into God's kingdom. If it depended upon our goodness, we would not yet have put our foot on the bottom rung of the ladder to take the first step toward the kingdom of God. But in his mercy and in his goodness, thank God, Jesus Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us.